Now, the last class, the last chapter rather, the ninth chapter, ended the instructions of the Avadhuta Brahmana, Dattatreya, to Maharaj Yadu. But, of course, the larger context is the instructions that Krishna is giving to Uddhava. Uddhava was, when he understood that Krishna was going to leave this world, he wanted to go with Krishna, and Krishna told him he had some service for him. I don't want to get involved in local politics. So the first instructions in chapter 7 through 9, the last chapters that we heard, that very much on detachment, given and learning how to see Krishna from material world. But as Srila Jiva Goswami pointed out, that it's not that one can just look at the material world and avoid surrender to, hearing from, and taking initiation from Guru. But once one has basic knowledge, one can enrich it by viewing the material world and seeing the philosophy of Krishna consciousness within the material world. But that Brahmana, he was so detached, Dattatreya, the Avadhuta, was so detached from anything to do with the material world. He just focused his consciousness on the Supreme, and he didn't really deal with the material world in any way whatsoever. So how to come to the level of detachment? That issue comes up next. And in this chapter 10, it starts in the practical sense of starting with vanashrama, or acting according to your nature. And then as you're acting according to your nature, naturally fruit comes from your performance of your prescribed vanashrama duties. Some results come. But one should be detached from the results, understanding oneself as a soul situated within a body. So this is more like this chapter here that we're going to read, chapter 10, is more like chapter 5 of the Bhagavad Gita than it is like chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita. So the point that's going to be made very strongly is that one should perform detached vanashrama duties. And by doing so, one will take the next step in the yoga ladder. And the yoga ladder will be from karma to jnana. So in the previous chapters, again, it was about jnana, learning detachment and focusing the consciousness on the Supreme from the material world. And this is this chapter 10, from performing one's vanashrama duties in a detached way will come true knowledge, true detachment from the material situation. Then in the 11th chapter, which we'll read tomorrow, then this detached karma yoga, it will lead to bhakti and its practices. And there will be a brief discussion or some discussion of the practices of bhakti and how karma yoga ultimately his purpose is to lead to bhakti. And then, in the next chapter, there will be discussion of confidential knowledge. It's the most confidential knowledge about the topmost position of the residents of Vrindavan in their performance of bhakti. So, in this Uddhav Gita, Krishna is going to give more emphasis on how everything leads to bhakti. Very, very direct and pointed, that everything leads to bhakti. And in the 12th chapter, he's going to describe the topmost devotees, the topmost bhaktis, the topmost position of service and of pleasing Krishna of the residents of Vrindavan. So we're still working our way there to 12 and through 10 and then 11, which we'll discuss this afternoon for 10 and tomorrow 11. So in the beginning of the 10th chapter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, so what, because there's a lot to cover, what I'll do is not read much in the way of purports and commentaries until we're sure we get through it, the entirety of the chapter, and then we'll move towards comments when we're sure we're through it. But, so again, the purpose of this chapter, chapter 10, is to teach us and show us and point out that karma or vanashrama duties is not meant for our to get sense objects. Now, where is the verse in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, in the early, what verse is that? Dhammasya upavargasya arta upakalpate dhammasya. So it's not, the purpose of working isn't sense gratification at all. It's not sense gratification at all. Rather, jnana is the purpose, or detachment from sense enjoyment is the purpose. And then, taking the more gradual path, then one will get to the point of bhakti, and that will be discussed in the next chapter again. So, because there is such a tendency, a strong tendency, for vanashrama and karma duties, karmic duties, to be performed for one's own pleasure after the second part of this chapter, which begins in verse 14, this section will discuss specifically the philosophy, the specific darshan or Vedic philosophy, karma mamangsa or purva mamangsa philosophy, that specifically teaches that the purpose of vanashrama is to get piety so that you can continuously enjoy. This is the basic smarta philosophy, that you have to perform the Vedic rituals perfectly so that your karma will be so pious that, practically speaking, you can enjoy forever. So Krishna will personally speak against that philosophy in the second part of this chapter. So first part is that karma, meaning the following of vanashrama duties, is meant for detached work, for detachment, so that the soul can situate himself or feel himself in the body, but not identify with the body. So Krishna makes this point clear and strong, very much like the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And then he will personally speak against this purva mamangsa, karma mamangsa philosophy spoken by Jamini Rishi, that the purpose of vanashrama duties is to get piety, increase of piety, so that one can enjoy. But rather he will speak about the purpose of vanashrama again being liberation. Apavagasya, dharmasya, apavagasya. Purpose of performing dharma or religious prescribed duties is apavaga or liberation. So we will begin. So the first 13 verses will discuss this, the principle of detached varnashrama duties. And then in the second part, Krishna himself will speak against this purva mamangsa or karma mamangsa or performing material duties to increase one's piety, which means, practically speaking, the capacity to enjoy. Krishna himself will speak against that. So here we'll begin. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, taking full shelter in me, with mind carefully fixed in devotional service, is the translation here, swadhameshu in dharma, as spoken by me, Marasraya, with mind carefully fixed in the devotional service of the Lord as spoken by me. One should live without personal desire and practice the social and occupational system called vanashrama. One should practice vanashrama. If one is on the level of devotional service, one should practice devotional service while within one's position in society. And live in such a way that one doesn't become entangled in the material world. Because one's focus should be on attaining the spiritual world. One may have to live in society, perform practical duties, but one's focus and purpose, one's intention, should be on the service of Krishna, developing Krishna consciousness. Changing one's consciousness from exploiter, enjoyer of the material world to Gopi Bhartapada Kamalayoa Dasa Dasana Das. So either one does it directly or indirectly. The Uddhava Gita will teach us that we should have this as our goal. And ultimately, of course, the direct system is recommended. So the second verse. A purified soul should see that because the conditioned souls who are dedicated to sense gratification have falsely accepted the objects of sense pleasure as truth, all of their endeavors are doomed to failure. So there is, that's an object of knowledge, or object of intelligence, a purpose of intelligence. With intelligence, one can see the future. That is a function of intelligence. One can see the future. So, with one's intelligence, if we see someone jumping off the top floor of a very high building, he's jumping upward. But with his intelligence, he understands that that upward part of his jump is very, very temporary, and the result is going to be a disaster for the person, a physical disaster, and probably death. So that's the intelligence. So with intelligence, one should see the very nature of activities in the material world as doomed to failure. So those who are dedicated to sense gratification have falsely accepted the objects of sense pleasure as truth. But the person with intelligence sees this as a false acceptance. One who is sleeping, an example, may see many objects of sense gratification in a dream, but such pleasurable things are merely creations of the mind, and they are ultimately useless, because you don't stay dreaming like that forever. You wake up and they vanish. Similarly, the living entity who is asleep to a spiritual identity also sees many sense objects, but these innumerable sense objects, innumerable objects of temporary gratification are creations of the Lord's illusory potency and have no permanent existence. One who meditates on them, impelled by the senses, uselessly engages his intelligence. The creations, the objects of sense gratification, they are creations of the Lord's illusory potency and they have no permanent existence. So there's two ways that they are creations of the Lord's illusory potency. One is that their very existence is a creation of the Lord's Maya Shakti. So we study the third canto of the Bhagavatam. We study the earlier chapters that we heard about before with the questions of King Nimi about the nature of Maya. It's an expansion. We heard in the last chapter how this Maya energy is an expansion of the Lord's potency, and it creates the ingredients, the physical objects, out of false ego and the mode of ignorance. The physical objects are created by Krishna's Maya Shakti. So that's one sense in which the material world is an expansion of Krishna's Maya Shakti. And another sense is that we view these objects as if they are meant for our pleasure. And not only as if they are meant for our pleasure, but as if we can actually get pleasure from them. So when we see a dog eating in the gutters of Vrindavan or something, eating terrible things, or a pig eating terrible things, and the dog is thinking those things are enjoyable. So when we see that, we are disgusted. We are completely repulsed. But those are the objects of the senses that are suitable, that are made attractive by Maya, by the body he has. They appear attractive to that animal. But when we see our own objects of senses, because every sense has its objects, when we see object of our own senses that are natural for someone in a human body, we become involved in that illusion and we don't see them as repulsive. Well, we see the dog doing the same things as eating, sleeping, mating, defending. We see that as ridiculous and repulsive. But our own objects of the senses, because we don't have objectivity in that, we identify with the body and we see them as attractive. But actually it's the same type of ridiculous illusion. And ultimately, philosophically, in illusion, we think that there's pleasure there, but actually there's only destruction there. And there is only the cause of repeated birth and death there. But due to our lack of objectivity, but meaning we don't have the sense of aloofness in regard to our own bodies and our own minds, we fall into the trap of identifying with the body and mind, and we try to squeeze pleasure from the body and mind, and therefore we fully identify, we invest our sense of self, that ahankar, aham mamati, we invest our sense of self in the body, in the senses, and the objects of the senses. Do you follow what I mean by that? We invest our sense of self in it. A simple example, the one that comes to my mind is if I have my iPad and it's mine because I've invested my sense of self in it, it's my possession, and it's mine, and if it gets stolen, which we hope it won't happen because we've put so many good things on it, so many books and videos and Prabhupada and this and that, then I experience pain. But if someone else loses their iPod, even if they may have the same things on it, and I may feel some sympathy, if he's my friend or something like that, but otherwise it doesn't cause me the same pain. Well, the clever example, of course, if it's my car and it gets hit by another car, it causes me pain. But if someone else's car gets hit, it doesn't cause me pain. That's called ahankar. Identification with the car as me. It's an expansion of me. It's a sense of the sense of self of I am is impressed upon other objects, and those are called mine. But they have no permanence. It is Maya that makes me think of them as mine. So in the fourth verse, Krishna says, one who has fixed me within his mind, within his consciousness, as the goal of life, should give up activities based on sense gratification and should instead execute work governed by the regulative principles for advancement. When, however, one is fully engaged in searching out the ultimate truth of the soul, one should not accept the scriptural injunctions governing fruitive activities. So here a distinction is made for in the realm of vanashrama duties and karma. So there is a person who is performing his prescribed duties, everything in the Vedic scriptures. He's doing what he should be doing according to the Vedic prescriptions. So he's taking the enjoyments, following everything, taking the enjoyments of the heavenly planets, etc. So that's one type of a person. Nope. Wrong choice. Yep. That one was good, but yes. Okay. No. Does anyone have the lighting scheme? It's either that or we'll use a rock. It must be a different switch. If we've turned all of them. Okay. It's all your prayers and well wishes that have caused the light. Let there be light. And it was good. So one division, if we die thinking about a dog, what will we become? Consider that. And do the needful. So one type of a person follows completely because his level of consciousness is wanting enjoyment, and his wanting enjoyment is better within the Vedic system. That's called the path of Pravritti Marg. So he's enjoying it according to the Vedic system. But one who is established in the truth, establishing that the purpose of his life is to focus the mind on Krishna, he doesn't follow in the same way as a person who isn't so spiritually evolved. He follows only the appropriate injunctions of the Vedic Shastras that don't bring him material enjoyment, that don't involve him in fruitive activities, because his focus is very, very clear. His focus is fixed and it's clear because he wants advancement in spiritual life. One who is accepted, text 5, me as the supreme goal of life, should strictly observe scriptural injunctions forbidding sinful activities, and as far as possible should execute the injunctions prescribing minor regulative duties such as cleanliness. Ultimately, however, one should approach a bona fide spiritual master who is full of knowledge of me, is full of knowledge of me as I am, knowledge of me as I am, who is peaceful, who by spiritual elevation is none different from me. So when one is serious about the spiritual path, the prescription again is to accept a guru not different from the instructions given to King Nimi, that this is the process of getting out of material existence. And now some of the qualities of the disciple and the path that he's following. The servant or disciple of the spiritual master should be free from false prestige, never considering himself to be the doer. He should be active. What's the opposite of active? Inactive. Very good. Passive or even lazy. And never lazy, and should give up all sense of proprietorship over the objects of the senses, including his wife, children, home, and society. These things, in other words, are not meant for my enjoyment. My being the owner of them, they are meant for my enjoyment. No, a different type of mentality is there, although such a person may be engaged in similar activities, but his consciousness is different and his activities are somewhat different. He should be endowed with feelings of loving friendship towards the spiritual master and should never become deviated or bewildered. So strong injunctions. Never become deviated or never become bewildered. What does it mean to become bewildered and deviated? It means to forget what the purpose of life is and to become attracted by the objects of the senses or the objects of the mind and become bewildered as to what the actual purpose of life is. And then when one is bewildered, one becomes deviated and goes in the wrong direction. The servant or disciple should always desire advancement in spiritual understanding, should not envy anyone, and should always avoid useless conversation. Gramya katana shunive. One should see one's real self-interest in life in all circumstances. One should keep conscious of what I actually want. It's a good thing for a devotee to do, is to bring to the forefront of his consciousness, what is it, the answer to the question, what do I actually want? Not write an essay about it, not to make it public, but to clarify in one's own consciousness in an honest and simple way, what do I actually want? And then try to make one's life harmonious with achieving what one actually wants. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? To make your life harmonious with what you want. But very often, what we want is mixed. So we say, what do I want? And then we say, what do I really want? Or ultimately want, because sometimes what we want isn't harmonious with what we really want, or ultimately want, or at different times of our life, we want different things. So these are the matters of an introspective person to consider. What do I really want? Do I really want what I say I really want? And what should I do about it? What should I do? And how should I deal with other desires, etc.? But what do I really want? One should see one's real self-interest in life in all circumstances. In other words, act with what is actually beneficial for one, and don't become bewildered, don't become deviated, but decide in all circumstances that this is what I want, and how to, and then bring one's life in harmony with what is one's true desire. And therefore, remain detached from wife, children, home, land, relatives, friends, wealth, and so on. Now there's verses from the sixth canto that are relevant in this, and I'll just read those quickly. Just as gold, this is 6:16 from the 16th verse, 6 and 7. Just as gold and other commodities are continually transferred from one place to another in due course of purchase and sale. Following the metaphor there, there's gold, you buy it, it's yours, you sell it, it's, someone else is saying it's mine. So the living entity, as a result of his fruit of activities, wanders throughout the entire universe, being injected into various bodies and different species of life by one kind of father after another. So this is the perspective of life that we should use as a basic frame of reference as we live our life. And we should take our possessions, including our family, etc., in this perspective. We should view them in that perspective. As the verse said, this is the point of the verse. A few living entities are born in a human species, in the human species, and others are born as animals, but everyone is on a similar cycle. Although both are living beings, living entities, their relationships are impermanent. An animal may remain in the custody of a human being for some time, and then the same animal may be transferred to the possession of other human beings. As soon as the animal goes away, the former proprietor, the former owner, no longer has a sense of ownership. As long as the animal is in his possession, he certainly has an affinity for it. He likes it. He thinks of it as mine. But as soon as the animal is sold, the affinity is lost. So the point being of those verses is that we think so many things are mine, but we should understand that as we are, even the body is temporarily ours. What to speak of the possessions that we think of as mine? So naturally we have affinity We like the things that we think are mine, but it is only temporary. So it shouldn't involve our full consciousness in the land of the temporary. Rather, we should keep our consciousness in the land of the eternal. So, because it's in our self-interest. Just as a fire which burns and illuminates is different from firewood. Is fire different from firewood? Yes, very good. Is fire different from firewood? There's an example coming up. Just as fire which burns and illuminates is different from firewood, which is to be burned to give illumination to, so we can see. Similarly, the seer within the body, the soul, the person who's observing things within the body, the self-enlightened spirit soul, is different from the material body, which is to be illuminated by consciousness. Because somehow or another, at some point in our life, we become aware that we exist. And suddenly, there we are, in a particular body, with a particular mind, and we have particular likes, dislikes, we speak a particular language, we have a particular gender, color of the skin, voice quality, talent. But there we are, and we suddenly just sort of like, it appears like when you become conscious of it, you've popped into existence in a particular circumstance. The consciousness is aware of itself and its qualities radiating throughout the body. And in illusion, it identifies with these things as itself. But what the verses are saying is that they're temporarily yours, and later you're thinking they're yours, but just like the possession of gold or an animal, it's yours now, but later it's someone else's. So the body becomes illumined by consciousness and we become aware of ourselves. Thus the spirit soul and the body possess different characteristics, consciousness and the object of consciousness, and are separate entities. Now this simple philosophy that we learn in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that we've said so many times, you're not your body, Prabhu, or whatever, this simplest ABC philosophy of Krishna consciousness is practically not spoken in any other religion of the world, practically. Simple point, simplest point. We are souls, we are eternal, the body is temporary. There's no religions practically that even say this simple point. What to speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Goloka Vrindavan? But until one understands this point that you're eternal and you leave it all behind, all those things that are temporarily yours, there's no talking about where you're going to go. There's no talking about that you're going to leave the family behind and you're eternal and you're going to go in your eternal as an eternal soul to deal on the spiritual level with the eternal, fully spiritual personality of Godhead. There is no possibility of that concept when you're speaking about the spiritual future, your spiritual future, unless you understand that this body is not me. My body is not me. And if you say to an ordinary person, this body is not you. Well, they say, well, if this body is not me, which body is me? Because lack of understanding that we're eternal. So the soul and the body possess different characteristics. So what's the difference in the characteristics? Well, the soul cannot be burnt, dried, withered by the wind, etc., as per the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Nahanyate, hanyamane, sharire, it is not, doesn't die, etc. And the body can be burnt, it can be dried, it can be withered by the wind, etc. Just as fire may appear differently as dormant, manifest, weak, brilliant, and so on, according to the conditions of the fuel, similarly the spirit soul enters a material body and accepts particular bodily characteristics, like a dog And you have only a certain part of your consciousness is manifest when you're in a dog body. And a human body is the chance for the soul to manifest so much more of the of his capacity of consciousness. And then ultimately, the full capacity of his consciousness in relationship to the Supreme Lord. The subtle and gross material body. So here is the jnana that comes as one acts as a human being in the vanashrama system, learning from a spiritual master. Learning from a spiritual master means learning shastra. Basic shastra, Bhagavad Gita. Learning it from the spiritual master, from a spiritual master. So the subtle, what it does is this type of knowledge pulls one out of the bodily concept, that one's perspective on life and what's purpose and what's meaningful activities has changed completely. Because that which seems to be meaningful for a person who thinks he's the body is completely different from that which is considered meaningful for a person who considers himself an eternal soul. The perspective is completely different. So the subtle and gross material bodies are created by the material modes of nature, which expands from the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Material existence occurs when the living entity falsely accepts the qualities of the gross and subtle bodies as being his own factual nature. So this is what we go through every day, struggling against the conditioned soul's tendency to accept the body and mind and its characteristics as himself. I look in the mirror and I think, this is me. As opposed to, this is, when you're old, you look in and think, this is who? There's one, talking about the iPad, there's one program that you can download, a free program, that I don't know who thought of this idea, but it allows you to take a picture, a photograph of yourself, and change its characteristics. You put it onto some kind of a mask on it, a photo mask, and you can see what you'll look like in 30 years. What you'll look like in 30 years. This is the most unpopular program that you can, of the free download. You couldn't sell it for 5 cents or anything, or 5 paisa, because no one wants to see that. Rather, if you had the other one, you know, old person, you can see what he looked like 20 years ago, be more attractive. Because we identify with this in illusion, and this is Maya. This illusory state of accepting the qualities of the body and mind as oneself can be destroyed by real knowledge. This is our basic preaching, isn't it? And if we think of the body as ourself, who can argue with the fact of the verse that said that right in the beginning that it is doomed? But if that's us, it's and people will accuse devotees of being cynical or thinking, not being hopeful. But how can you be hopeful looking at the material body and looking at the material bodies of the elderly, knowing that that's going to happen to me, and that you're going to die, and that you're going to turn into ashes or dust or something like that? Is that being cynical? Or is that being, what's the right word? Realistic. It's just looking it in the eye, looking at reality. It's realistic. Looking at reality. So real knowledge destroys illusion. So someone can make the point, what you're saying, it's like fire and fuel. You use that example, because that was the example that Krishna uses. That aren't they interdependent? Don't they depend on each other? Can you have fire Without fuel? Has anyone ever tried this, by the way, to have a fire without fuel? It doesn't work very well. So therefore, if you use your analogy even, can the soul exist without a body? Good point, isn't it? Clever. Someone was listening. So according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, looking for the commentary, looking in the purport here, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, our material existence is an artificial imposition by the Lord's inconceivable potency of nescience, maya. The qualities of gross and subtle material forms are psychologically imposed upon the living being. Actually, the point that he's going to make, in fact, and this comes out in the, I think in the next chapter, more, that there is no connection at all. There is no interdependence of the body and the soul. There is no actual connection other than maya, other than illusion. So if there is no connection between two things other than something, an imaginary connection, it means there's no connection. It's a heavy point when we consider how much we're attached and tangled with our bodies and minds. I mean, isn't it? When, if there's no connection, and then you can take it philosophically, theoretically, but then when you think about me and the way I usually proceed through my life, it's heavy. That means I'm an illusion. And Krishna seems so far away. And the whole verses we've been reading, last chapter, this chapter, is that there's no possibility of being disconnected from Krishna. It's not illusion. And what I'm considering illusion, or far away and distant of my relationship with Krishna, is reality, and what I'm considering reality is illusion. Now, what would you consider a person? How would you, if you had to name a person, not give him a name, but what category of person would it be, that a person who's, what he sees doesn't exist, and what he doesn't see is what exists? A lunatic. A lunatic, a crazy person. You just lock him up. Well, that's why we're in the material world. We're locked up here. Because we're crazy, basically. So, as explained in the previous chapter, the present material body is like a tree that produces the karmic seed of the next body. So beware, sadhu sabdhan, they say. Beware of how you act and how you, on the subtle and gross level, because it's going to produce other reactions. This cycle of ignorance or madness can be cut to pieces by the transcendental knowledge explained by the Lord. Next verse. Therefore, by the cultivation of knowledge, so the point, this is gyan. It's all these sections are coming from the jnana point of view. So by cultivation of knowledge, so the karma should bring us to the point of knowledge. And then the next chapter will be to the point of bhakti. And then the next chapter after that, chapter 12, that the best of bhaktas, the resonance of Braj. Therefore, by the cultivation of knowledge, one should approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead situated within oneself. One could say, where is he situated? But if we read carefully, we could also say, where is he not situated? In the form of his energies, and he's between every atom and in every atom. So in illusion, we don't see that. But without Krishna's presence, what could exist? It's not that he's just started the thing moving, but what could exist without God, without the Supreme? Everything, mama angsa teja sambhava, everything rests upon me. Or mata parataram na anyat. Sutre maniganaiva, like pearls are strung on a thread. So we should come back to reality. That's the idea, going back to reality. And we should give up. Now, listen to this. By understanding this, by the cultivation of knowledge, one should approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead situated within oneself. And by understanding the Lord's pure transcendental existence, one should gradually give up the false vision of the material world as an independent reality. Independent reality means separate from Him. The spiritual master can be compared to the lower kindling stick, the disciple to the upper kindling stick, and the instructions given by the guru to the third stick placed in between. The transcendental knowledge communicated from guru to disciple is compared to the fire arising from the contact of these, which burns the darkness of ignorance to ashes, bringing great happiness to the guru and disciple. So all the wood is burned too. By submissively hearing, and this is the last verse in this section, by submissively hearing from an expert spiritual master, the expert disciple develops pure knowledge of who he is and who he is not, which repels the onslaught of material illusion arising from the three modes of material nature. Finally, this pure knowledge itself ceases, just as fire ceases when the stock of fuel has been consumed. Okay. So, what this is teaching up to this point is the process of Nivritti Marga, as opposed to what the Varnashram or the Karmakanda sections of the Vedas teach is Pravritti Marga. The purpose of following these injunctions is detachment, knowledge and detachment. Detachment comes from knowledge, and liberation comes from knowledge. So now Krishna is going to speak further. My dear Uddhav, I have thus explained to you perfect knowledge. There are philosophers, however, who challenge my conclusion. They state that the natural position of the living entity is to engage in fruitive activities. And they see him as the enjoyer of happiness and unhappiness that accrue, that come from his own work. According to this materialistic philosophy, the world, time, the revealed scriptures, and the self are all variegated and eternal, existing as a perpetual flow of transformations. So the material world has no beginning and an end, they just transform. Knowledge, moreover, cannot be one or eternal, because it arises from the different and changing forms of objects. Thus, knowledge itself is always subject to change. So this is different from what Krishna says, but this is the philosophy he's presenting and is going to challenge. Even if you accept such a philosophy, my dear Uddhava, that the material world is just shifting and it's changing, and you, as an eternal soul, cannot be freed from it because it's eternal and you're eternal, and your proper position, according to the Vedas, is to stay in relationship with the material world and act in a pious way so that your situation within the realm of matter will be enjoyment and not suffering. My dear Uddhav, there will be perpetual death, birth, old age, and disease, since all living entities must accept the material body subject to the influence of time. So, this is the, according to Vishwanath, this is there's an explanation in the purport. It would be nice, so nice to read this. But what Krishna is saying, that what I've explained before is the actual truth, and now this is the philosophy of Jaimini Rishi, Purvamamangsa, Karmamamangsa philosophy. So this is basically it's very similar to the materialistic philosophy that you're going to die, so you might as well enjoy, manipulate the material energy. But the Karmamamangsa philosophy is accepting the Vedas so with such faith, they say, but follow the Vedas and you will enjoy piously. And then you will really enjoy. And if you don't follow the Vedas, you will try to enjoy in a tamaguni way and you'll suffer. So Krishna doesn't want Uddhav to follow this philosophy, either the materialistic philosophy or the karma mangsa philosophy. He continues, although the performer of fruitive activities desires perpetual happiness, it is clearly observed that materialistic workers are often unhappy and only occasionally satisfied, thus proving they are not independent or in control of their destiny. When a person is always under the superior control of another, how can he expect any valuable result from his own fruitive actions? Because you can't act in the way that you want to act, and therefore you can't get the result that you want to act. And therefore everyone has such a mixture of happiness and misery. It is observed within the material world that sometimes even an intelligent person is not happy. Similarly, sometimes even a great fool is happy. The concept of becoming happy through expertly performing material activities is simply a useless exhibition of false egotism. Same thing with the material scientists, except it's not pious, and therefore the results are horrendous instead of anything resembling favorable. Because they think we can manipulate our karma, the material energy, so that we can become happy. We will get everyone high-speed ADSL, and you'll be able to shop and without going out of your room, and they'll all be delivered to you, and there'll be no more bookstores because everything will be online, and there'll be no more newspapers, and everything will be delivered to your door, and the cows will give... Cows? How do they fit in? Cows? No. Well, and so you don't depend on rain, we'll find another, you just take pills, and this and that, and we have a better way than the natural God-given way. We have a better idea for your pleasure. And people, and you don't need gold anymore. Transfer your gold to paper money, and then from paper to plastic money, from plastic money to credit cards, and everything is just a transfer. Nothing natural. Everything will be genetically modified. You'll be genetically modified, and you'll be designed. You'll be a designer. Your children will be designer kids, and we'll alleviate all disease. Replace your eyes. Replace your kidneys. Replace your lungs. Your heart. Artificial hip. Artificial. Artificial. What else?
Teeth.
Huh?
Legs.
Teeth. That we already are getting. Artificial, they have artificial teeth, they have artificial kidneys, artificial
heart.
Brain.
No, they don't have those yet. Lungs, kidneys. Oh, no. And the result, despite all the promises, is hell. So in the Vedic system, but it's the same basic mood of manipulating the material energy, but the Vedic system uses the documentation that Krishna has provided for the material world, so it works better than this, the hacked version that I never thought of it like that before, but it's true. They're hacking into the material energy and they're messing things up. Death is, so Krishna's giving the arguments against this philosophy that it doesn't work. Even the pious version of manipulation through the Vedas doesn't work. Even if people knew how to achieve happiness and avoid unhappiness, they still do not know the process by which death will not be able to exert its power over them. They don't know, and they never will know. Death is not at all pleasing. When the material world, it means death. There's no avoiding it, Krishna is saying. Death is not at all pleasing. It's terrifying. And all the plans, all the intellectual adjustments, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, I'm going to prearrange my funeral. And since everyone is exactly like a condemned man being led to the place of execution, what possible happiness can people derive from material objects or the gratification they provide? So Krishna is being heavy and exact and truthful. That material happiness of which we hear such as promotion to the heavenly planets for celestial enjoyment, is just like the material happiness we have already experienced. Both are polluted by jealousy, envy, decay, and death. Such an interesting point, why we can't be happy in the material world, because there is jealousy. Can you be happy if you're jealous? Can you be happy if you're envious? Can you be happy if your body is decaying and dying? And the answer is no. Therefore, just as an attempt to raise crops becomes fruitless if there are many problems, like crop disease, insect plague, or drought, similarly, the attempt to attain material happiness, either on earth or the heavenly planets, is always fruitless because of innumerable, uncountable obstacles. If one performs Vedic sacrifices and fruitive rituals without any mistake or contamination, which in Kali Yuga is not possible, that's my comment, one will achieve a heavenly situation in the next life. But even this result, which is only achieved by perfect performance of fruitive rituals, will be vanquished by time. Now hear of this, because this is the basic karma amongst the philosophy. If on earth one performs sacrifices for the satisfaction of the demigods, he goes to the heavenly planets, where just like a demigod, he enjoys all of the heavenly pleasures he has earned by his performances. And sometimes that is very appealing. But having achieved the heavenly planets, the performer of ritualistic sacrifices travels in a glowing airplane, which he obtains as a result of his piety on earth, and being glorified by song sung by the Gandharvas and dressed in wonderful, charming clothes, he enjoys life surrounded by heavenly goddesses. Accompanied by heavenly women, the enjoyer of the fruits of sacrifice goes on pleasure rides in a wonderful airplane which is decorated with circles of tinkling bells and which flies wherever he desires. Being relaxed, comfortable, and happily in the heavenly pleasure gardens, he does not consider that he's exhausting the fruits of his piety and will soon fall down to the mortal world. If a human being is engaged in sinful irreligious activities, either because of bad association, so that was the result of pious deeds, enjoyment, yes, but only for a short time, short in comparison to eternity, long in comparison to our ant-like, bug-like existence, but short in comparison to eternity. And reality is eternity. So that was the enjoyment given to someone who's pious, who acts piously, perfectly performing the Vedic rituals. And the result is not good. But then those who act impiously will now be described what happens to them. If a human being is engaged in sinful, irreligious activities, either because of bad association or because of his failure to control his senses, then such a person will certainly develop a personality full of material desires. And this is the unfortunate result of engaging in materialistic sensual activities, is that it fills the consciousness with more of the same. And one's own mind plagues one and tortures one with its desires. He thus becomes miserly towards others, greedy, and always anxious to exploit the bodies of women. When the mind is so polluted, one becomes violent and aggressive, and without the authority of Vedic injunctions, slaughters innocent animals for sense gratification. Worshipping ghosts and spirits, so passion, going to ignorance, desiring due to bad association, irreligious activities, those desires turn into ignorance, the passion turns to ignorance, and then one's activities become worse, more degraded, more degrading, and more bringing more horrendous results. Worshipping ghosts and spirits, the bewildered person falls fully into the grip of unauthorized activities and thus goes to hell, where he receives a material body infected by the darkest modes of nature, dark, distress-causing tendencies are built into the hardware and software of that material body. In such a degraded body, he unfortunately continues to perform inauspicious activities that greatly increase his future unhappiness, and therefore he again accepts a similar material body. What possible happiness can there be for one who engages in activities inevitably terminating in death? And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakura, if Lord Brahma's day of 8,640,000,000 years becomes afflicted with death, fear of death, then what to speak of our situation? What happiness can one find when one is condemned in such a way? And all the planetary systems, from the heavenly to the hellish, and for all the great demigods who live for 1,000 yuga cycles, there is fear of me, Krishna says, kalosmin lokachaya krit, in my form of time. Even Brahma, who possesses the supreme lifespan of 311,440,000,000,000 years, is also afraid of me in my form of time. No one is fearless. Everyone fears Krishna in that form. No one is arrogant then. So both pious and impious people end in death. The material senses create material activities, either pious or sinful. And the modes of nature set the material senses into motion. Therefore, devotees should be careful to cultivate the mode of goodness. The living entity, because the mode of passion and ignorance is so dangerous, so very dangerous. The living entity, being fully engaged by the material senses and material modes of nature, experiences the various results of fruit of work. As long as the living entity thinks that the modes of material nature have separate existence, now I'm going to ask you a question after I read this verse about the meaning of that separate existence. As long as the living entity thinks that the modes of material nature have separate existence, he will be obliged to take birth in many different forms and will experience varieties of material existence. Therefore, the living entity remains completely dependent on fruitive activities under the modes of nature. So what does that mean? As long as he thinks, because as long as we think in this way, that the modes of nature have separate existence, then a terrible result is going to come. So what does it mean to have a separate existence?
It means that we're not saying that they're coming from Krishna.
Yes, exactly. And therefore, that coming from Krishna means that they have a connection with Krishna. So to see Krishna, when we see the modes of nature, they are in his. They are his. Everything in both the upadankara and the things of the material substances and the forces, they're all Krishna. Krishna's energies. Krishna in the form of his energies. And if we don't see in that way that they're Krishna's and Krishna's energies, we'll see them as independent from him, and therefore they are meant for the pleasure of me. Bhunkte prakriti janiha. And therefore, I will try to exploit them. And in my attempt for exploitation, I will become entangled in them. They will control me. I'm trying to control them for my pleasure, but they will control me. And I will be dependent, pushed around by these modes of material nature, leading to terrible results. Pious, terrible results, or impious, terrible results. The conditioned soul who remains dependent on fruitive activities under the control, under the modes of material nature, will continue to fear me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, since I impose the results of one's fruitive activities. Those who accept the material concept of life, taking the variegatedness of the modes of nature to be factual, in other words, seeing them as separate from Krishna, they devote themselves to material enjoyment and are therefore always absorbed in what? Not happiness, but lamentation and grief. The plan is happiness. The desire is happiness. The hope is happiness, but the result is lamentation and grief, because how can one be happy if one's consciousness is full of jealousy, envy, greed, etc.? And the only person who doesn't have this, put it another way, when we have false ego, we must have these things. We must have anger, we must have envy, we must have greed when we have false ego. And the only one who doesn't have these things is Krishna, because the only way for a materialist to not be afflicted by lust, anger, greed, etc., is to be fully in control of everything in existence. So, that's Krishna. So therefore, we're in direct competition with reality. And if we fight reality, we will win or lose. Circle the correct, which one? If we fight reality, we will lose. We cannot fight reality. We have to surrender to reality. Why? Because it's real. You can fight illusion. That's what we do. But we can't fight reality. We will only be defeated, because reality is real. Illusion is false. 33 or 34. When there is agitation and interaction of the material modes of nature, the living entities then describe me. So a conditioned soul perceives me, Krishna, when he's under the influence of the material nature, as all-powerful time. He can perceive the supremacy, or rather the dominance of Krishna, but he sees it not in his personal form, but in these ways that Krishna manifests his dominance within the material world. He sees Krishna as all-powerful time, self, the supersoul, Vedic knowledge, the universe, one's own nature, religious ceremonies, and so on, something else that are impelling one, are seen as the supreme forces within this world. And what the devotee wants to do is to be impelled by bhakti, by devotion. Why? Because it will bring Krishna pleasure. And why give Krishna pleasure? Because that's natural for the soul, and there's no other way for the soul to get pleasure unless he becomes a devoted, loving servant of Krishna. It's a matter of surrendering to that identity, and that's essentially what surrender means. Beginning with placing ourselves under Krishna's protection. But this is who I am. I am Krishna's eternal servant. I may not be able to proceed immediately like that, but using karma yoga, this yoga, that yoga, whatever, or bhakti in its different forms under the prescription of those who know how to prescribe the process, the doctors in spiritual life, I'll either proceed straight, or like this, or like this, or like this, or slowly, like this. But my goal and my proceeding is clear. So Uddhava, after hearing this, so Krishna has spoken two things. In the first, he said, Varnashrama, bringing knowledge ultimately of relationship with me, and perform your duties in a detached way and get knowledge. And secondly, secondarily, don't think that there's even a pious way to enjoy this, be the enjoyer in this world, because the position is already taken by me. And the peace formula is to accept me as the enjoyer. Bhoktaram jagatapasam. So Uddhava asks a question. In two verses he'll ask questions, and this is the foundation of the next chapter. Because he's been listening. Please listen to his question. It's quite interesting what he asks. Oh my Lord, a living entity situated within the material body, that's simple to understand, the soul and the body, is surrounded by the modes of material nature, yes? And the happiness and distress that he's experiencing are born of the activities caused by the modes. So there's him, the modes, and his happiness and distress. How is it possible that he is not bound by the material by material encirclement? How can he be liberated? It may also be said that the living entity is ultimately transcendental. So he's a soul. He doesn't have anything to do with the material world. And has nothing to do with the material world, then how is he ever bound by material nature? So if he's looking at it from one point of view, he's a living entity, he's got the modes around him, he's experiencing happiness and distress caused by the modes. How can he become free? And if he's a soul that's eternal, that doesn't mix with anything material any more than oil mixes with water, how can he be bound? And then the second verse, which is a similar question. There's two questions here. Oh my Lord, Achyuta, the same living entity is sometimes described as eternally conditioned, Nityabadha, and other times as eternally liberated, Nityasiddha, eternally perfected, Nityamukta. So how could he be, if you're eternally, how could you be eternally one or the other? If you're eternally, you have to be, you can't be one and then the other. How could the eternal living entity become bound, and how come a bound living entity can become eternally free? I'm not able to understand, therefore, the actual situation of the living entity. So this complex relationship between the living entity and the illusory energy, he's asking about. You, my Lord, are the best of those who are expert in answering philosophical questions. Please explain to me the symptoms, next question, by which one can tell the difference between a living entity who is eternally liberated and one who is eternally conditioned. So what's this connection, and then what's the symptoms? So also, like the Bhagavad Gita has the symptoms, second chapter, and what other chapter? Of those who are free and those who are conditioned. In what various ways do they remain situated? Enjoy life, eat, evacuate, lie down, sit or move about. Well, we've just finished the 10th chapter. You all were remarkably attentive, all things considered, considering that we went through it quickly. Do you have a feel for what it was about, too? Or are you all just simply overloaded with information? Well, I guess no one can answer that question for all. But you have a feel for what the chapter, the two parts of the chapter, basically, and what's going on? Yes? No? Should we do it again tomorrow? Allotted one day. And we didn't read any of the wonderful purports or commentaries and things. But anyway. So we'll take questions for not more than 5 minutes till a quarter after, and then we shall break. And then, because tomorrow we won't do two chapters, but 11 is, and also this, it's jnana moving to bhakti. This one was like karma, how to do karma so it hits detachment or jnana. And tomorrow there's bhakti in there. We'll get some relief from the jnana too. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Sometimes see our glossary presented in a way rejecting Kama Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti as something antithetical to pure bhakti. At the same time here, it seems to be presented as one
singular, even a flow, but one singular teaching with different layers.
Levels or layers?
Layers. Or practice. And yeah. Also, Krishna explicitly says, Yathakramam, there are different steps of sadhana, and you proceed step by step, yeah. You proceed gradually.
Yes.
Is there the contradiction between Shuddha or Kevala Bhakti and Mishra Bhakti, or are they just different layers of the same process for our practice? Should we be afraid of Mishra Bhaktis?
A few points. One is that nothing but pure bhakti can satisfy the soul. And when Vyasadeva was feeling dissatisfied after compiling so much of the Vedic literature, Narada Muni chastised him and criticized him for his presenting Mishra forms of things, because people become confused. So people become confused. So he said, you have to speak directly about the Supreme Lord for people to actually become satisfied. You have to give that. But yet, there are means to gradually approach the platform of purity, of pure devotional service. So both are there. But yet, we shouldn't confuse the two. So what was specifically criticized by Narada was, if you present them without the perspective of pure devotional service, people naturally aren't going to want to take up something so renounced, because they won't understand the satisfaction. They're incapable of understanding the satisfaction that comes from direct relationship with Krishna. So if you present them this, they'll get stuck on that platform. So not only is that what you will call contradiction present here, but it's also presented in the Bhagavad Gita too, and so many other points of the Bhagavatam. So at the end, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's going to say, just take everything that I told you and just take it and roll it up in a ball and just surrender to me and begin pure bhakti. So what's happening here is, and I have one sheet that I think everyone can have, it's being retyped, that explains all the chapters in relationship to bhakti. You know, that in a very brief way, in one sentence, how this jnana is going to lead to bhakti. So what Krishna is really saying is take to bhakti, but that won't come out until the next chapter. And then furthermore, in chapter 12, it comes out still more clearly. So Krishna speaks indirectly sometimes, and we have to deal with it. Therefore, you have to have read the whole book, in one sense, before you can understand what his conclusion is, what he really wants out of you. And then also then, the more difficult problem comes, and we have to see if you're ready to do it, either a gradual way or a quick way. Because ultimately, we're all simply dependent on his mercy anyway. Because we're conditioned souls, so trapped in the material world. There's nothing we can do to force our way into the spiritual world, that we're dependent on his mercy. So that's, yes. Yes.
So is the utility of these sections only negative? Something to be rejected?
No, we can...
Well,
see the Avadhuta Brahmana. There are points that we pick on detachment that I've been calling Sangha Siddha Bhakta points, that have the almost the points of jnana that are useful when they're being used in devotional service. But the real point is the chanting and hearing points. Those you need, and they're useful in assistance, a scene when assistance is devotional service. But the real point is in Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, etc. And that's what Prahlad speaks about. That Navanga Bhakti, those are the ones with the inherent Shakti of Krishna in them. So we have to come to that point. And we have to maximize that in our life too. Okay, ask the same question again. No. Say it again. Yes, right now.
The first one?
No, the second one.
So is the utility of these chapters of the negative?
No, we take... Yeah. Is it negative only? We shouldn't be practicing jnana. We shouldn't be lying on the road like an avaduta.
That's how it's impractical, isn't it?
No, but there are points that we should pick up in it. But one has to be intelligent and read the purports and commentaries properly to understand how to apply all these things on the path of bhakti itself so that they assist in our bhakti. Because unless we're completely pure and fully sincere, we won't be able to chant and hear all day long. So we have to do other things. So the genius of Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, also they taught us in such a practical way how to see the material world as not separate from Mahaprabhu's mission with Nirbandha Krishna Sambandha Yukta Vairagya Ishite. Otherwise, if we couldn't engage the this and the this and the this and the heaters in Krishna's service, what would we do? You know, we wouldn't be able to be fully renounced personalities just getting all our nourishment from the holy names. We don't have that capacity, or very very few do anyway. Very few in Kali Yuga. So here's a way that we can use everything in Krishna's service using the principles that are taught here in the Jnana path, but in the Bhakti path. But still we have to know that the heart of the Bhakti path is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, etc., Navanga Bhakti, Panchanga Bhakti. And not become confused by the difference in instructions. To keep them all in the proper perspective. Which ones serve whom. And if we think, and if we don't have the purity, we won't have the... We'll branch out and go the wrong way. If we don't have proper guidance, we don't have proper association, we don't have proper shastric knowledge. Okay, let's stop here. We can talk more about these points because the whole Uddhava Gita is like that, practically speaking. It's jnana leading to bhakti, showing that the purpose of jnana is the giving of the soul to Krishna. That's perfection of jnana. Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Sri Krishna Uddhava Gita ki jai. Again, what's in one sense most interesting about and mysterious about this, the Uddhava Gita and the 11th canto, is that it follows the 10th canto. The 10th canto is a smiling face, it's so direct. How does this connect to that one that just ended once it's at the end?
To clean the misconceptions.
Clean the misconceptions, show how the whole Vedic path really ends in this, what we've just heard. This is the smiling face, and to equip us to go there, to give us all that we need to be able to go there. But Krishna makes it clear in the position of the 10th canto of Vrajabhakti in the 12th chapter. And again, it's so interesting that in Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami quotes so much from the 11th canto to prove the points of Abhideya. So that's also very significant. So there are things in there useful as so many things, assistance to the direct path of bhakti. Okay.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah. Well, yes, this is one for the tape recorder on, or the tape recorder? Yeah. Three more. Yeah.
In the 24 gurus, we have gurus teaching us what to do and what not to do. The last one with the spider.
Yeah.
Is there anything? Is there just that we should worship him, or is there also something teaching us what to do or what not to do?
I mean, we should worship the spider, in the same way we should worship the body. There were comments on that. No, we don't teach them. We don't see them as gurus, like we see our the fiction. Diksha Guru's Jiva Goswami made that point. That, like,
question is, if there is something you need to do by meditating on this guru?
Well, through the intelligence. Just get the intellect. Through the intelligence, get the point and act on the point. That's through all of them. They're intellectual points. They go through the intelligence.
Yeah, so is it worship? But this spider guru, does it teach us to worship Narayan? Or is there any more teachings of being detached from this world, like he is detached?
Like the spider is detached?
Are
there more specific instructions in addition to the ones that were specifically noted?
No, this particular one.
Yeah.
So,
about the spider, I'm saying. Just like you sent that about the other things we can learn from dogs and whatever.
So my question is, all the other 27 gurus, they seem to teach us to do something or to avoid something.
Yes.
But the spider, it just describes the Lord.
Yes.
So is the lesson that we learn from spider to worship the Lord, or is there also some practical lesson?
Negative, what we shouldn't do.
Shouldn't do, or how
we act
the world.
Well, we could probably think of so many things we can learn from spiders. But there doesn't seem to be one mentioned. Did you see any?
His detachment.
Was that mentioned?
Yeah, that he's not entangled and he's...
But he's detached, but he keeps it all within. So how detached is he if it's all within him anyway?
Coming back to this Mishra and Kavala, even in Jiva Goswami, especially in Shri Jiva Goswami, the Bhakti Sandarbha, it seems to be quite strong. Strongly emphasized that this Gyana Mishra, this is Gyana Mishra, this is, and even the 26 qualities, or qualities, 28 qualities.
Yeah, this Saranamam, that comes in the next chapter.
So it appears.
I'd prefer to let everyone go and then we could talk a bit further. Okay. I just have to be a little careful that my vata doesn't go too wild.
Do what?
My vata, because talking for a long time throws my vata.
Well, maybe we should let you go and torture you.
Okay, just ask it one more time. Because he wants, but you can use everything. The terms Jnana Misra Bhakti and Karma Misra Bhakti.
It's pradhanya still.
Okay, but there's they're not always clearly defined by the way we use them. Sometimes we use them is karma. We usually say bhakti mixed with karma. We want bhakti, but we mix with karma. But there's another way of using them that I've seen them use, that when you want the result of karma and use bhakti to get that result. So that's one point. I have to clarify which do you mean. Now, we also use it to mean we want bhakti, but the desire for karma is there. There's some traces of desire for karma or jnana there. So there's almost like three different meanings in there. So which one?
Basically, my problem is that we always see the emphasis on bhakti, and we are exhorted to give up all mixtures of karma and jnana and yoga.
But in what sense are we to give them up as assistance to our bhakti, or desiring those things? Which sense do you mean that we're exhorted to give them up?
As
Okay, now I understand why you're asking the question too. Okay.
Because my limited experience is that people who accept, who make endeavor, even through the so-called mixed bhakti, they are usually more cooperative and they are usually able to achieve something and do something and are useful to the mission and so forth.
Yes.
Much more pleasing to be with, to be around, even though they seem to employ externally something that could be classified, categorized as, in other words, they take care of their responsibilities socially, or they work on their qualities.
I can make two comments on that. One is there is a danger in mixing other things in. This is only one of the comments. And both have to be taken together, is that whatever you do that is useful to you, you become attached to. So that attachment can adulterate your attachment to Krishna. It can contaminate your attachment to Krishna. So that's one point. So that's on the danger side of incorporating yoga, jnana and karma, because ultimately we only want to be attached to Krishna. Now, another point is that so much depends actually on your motivation, in fact. So you can use the whole material world, you can use your family, you can use anything for Krishna's service, but it should be used with the attachment only for pleasing Krishna. The young gopis worship Kayani for Krishna. So utility is the principle, again, going back to that point. So there's the ultimate rule is whatever works, works. Whatever is, but works means pleasing to Krishna ultimately. So if Krishna wants you to do something and you know it's pleasing for him, the pure devotee will do anything to please Krishna, even go to hell, because the consideration is Krishna's pleasure only. So that's a second point. So it's not as black and white as the use of the thing or the not use of the thing. It's got to do with the consciousness. And a third point, so the first point was that danger of becoming attached, and the second point was if the motivation is pure, then it's perfect. It's perfected. And then the third point is that I may need these things now, which is maybe close to the first point. I may need these things now, but that doesn't mean I'll always need them. So the question is, should I pick up something now that I'll have to give up later on, or it will be fortuitous for me to give up because attachment may develop for something, and so should I pick up something now that I may have to give up? And we know clearly that the glory of bhakti is that the ends and the means are the same. So when we're more focused on the direct bhakti things, we're in a most fortunate situation from that point of view, because we've seen so many times that people, that I remember used to be devotees selling paintings and things like that to support the movement, so, and they would give everything, but then after time they ended up giving less. Very often it happened, not in all cases, but until when they left, that very same thing was the way they make their money, just for themselves and don't give anything to Krishna. So the problem with arupa siddha bhakti is that there's within it there's a tendency for the seed of karma, and the problem with Sangha Siddha Bhakti, within it there's a tendency for the seed of jnana, and bhakti doesn't have those things, direct practices of bhakti. But because this is a subtle question, and one other point is that therefore what one needs, what's best for one, should be prescribed by someone who's an expert physician. So what's best for me at this stage should be prescribed by someone who understands the strengths and pitfalls of whatever practice. Like you take any even Ayurvedic medicine, every medicine, not only the allopathic medicines, they do positive things and negative things.
We do have a historic example of the dangers of Swarupa Siddha Bhakti in the whole, 17th, 18th, 19th century, 20th century, profligate Usapa Sampradaya.
Yeah, but I remember when last year there was one class where I was reading from His Holiness Bhakti Prakash Maharaj's book on Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and I remember reading this one part, and I remember you went wow when Bhaktisiddhanta was quoted that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that to overly emphasize the holy names without the shastric instructions, without the Bhagavatam that tells you how to do it, was the cause of this. So not only so we say Harinama 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 Eva Kevalam Kalo Nasteva, but it doesn't mean to the exclusion of how to take it and the instructions and the shastra. And that point struck with me very much, very strongly as well, that you really need this balance naturally.
This was my question. So is there a way to have...
But the Bhagavatam is also in there.
Yeah.
Is part of the Srupsa the Bhakti items.
And the Bhagavatam is full of not even Jnana Misha, but Bhakti Misha Jnana. Not even Karma Misha Bhakti, but Bhakti Misha Karma.
Okay, which
even Gona is there.
The distinctions, one day...
Pradhanya and Gona.
Okay, but I have this... One day I'll have to get it in English, too. Yes, so the Bhagavatam teaches everything, but... Yeah, it teaches everything.
So is there a synthesis where... as you mentioned, the motivation. If the motivation is right, then...
Well, therefore, when Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Samita Sindhu, first thing he talks about is the motivation, anyabhilasita sunyam. And in Bhakti Sandarbha, that's what Jiva Goswami talks about as being the abhideya tattva. It's not the misras, it's the pure motivation. Jnana kama anavrita. Perform devotional service with... Anyabhilasita sunyam is the process of getting prema. So it also points to who the responsibility ultimately rests on. It depends on what you want, and it's our responsibility to be sincere, to actually, if we actually want Krishna, to perform the processes in such a way that we'll actually get Krishna. Because you can, what is the saying, that even the devil quotes shastra or scriptures, you can prove anything. Like Prabhupada said, and by Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, the Mayavadis quote everything.
My understanding is like Bhagavatam is like a full medical course. After reading that, you can prescribe to a particular person some medicine, like all the different type of processes are there. Ourself, then we can analyze and then we can take support from the senior devotees. What type of system?
And therefore, Jiva Goswami also explains that what's really talked about in the Bhagavatam is bhakti. He undergoes so much time to explain this in so many different, from the Karma Mimamsa theories, to show how bhakti is exactly what's being, that's the actually the only topic of Bhagavatam. And then we read that on the opening day of this course, we read that the quotation of Rupa Goswami from Nectar Devotion, Bhakti Samrita Sindhu, showing that there are two ways bhakti is talked about, direct and what shouldn't be done. So because we haven't finished the whole book, in the whole Gita, and therefore the there's, and even at the very end, Krishna is tricky about this. And when you read, when he took, even in the 29th chapter, right before Uddhava goes, when you know, he mentions all very much Jnana type of things, but seeing all living entities like that. But Vishwanath points out which parts are the real bhakti parts, the direct bhakti parts, and which aren't. So Krishna, he's tricky, but he had that quality ever since he was a kid. What can you expect? He is. He doesn't make it easy in that sense, you know. Why didn't he just have a Bhagavad Gita that said, you know, Savadharma, one verse, he could have just done the whole thing. But he has his way of doing things. Because he accomplishes multitasks, he brings everyone, he wants to bring all the jnanis, the karmis, he wants to line up everyone, and he wants to, but just like in the 9th chapter, the most confidential knowledge, he describes what's really in his mind, and then in 12 he's going to talk about the Braja, the gopis. So it depends what you want. You want to be dear to Krishna, or you want... So you know, so much relies on our sincerity in that sense. And that sincerity will dictate our understanding too. Except that, like Prabhupada's purports, completely insincere and not be able to misunderstand what Krishna says, because he's so direct. He's not into Prabhupada. To some degree.
Isn't it that if someone is partially insincere, Krishna will fill up the gap eventually. He will make some mention that the person is...
That's up to him, how he deals with everyone. But we hope that he sees the good. But we have to, if we're needy, that's helpful. I mean, who's going to say that they're sincere? Fully sincere. The devotees seem to just see their insincerity. So ultimately, our hope is on him, not on our understanding or anything. But we have to do our work too. That's the example in Damodar Lila. We have to do our sincere work. But we're ultimately dependent on his kind dispensation towards us. That's...
Only.
No, we have to know how to chant.
Yes, we should take instructions of Shastra.
Of course, to know how to chant. We have, because that's the whole point of the 10 offenses. You have to chant, but you can chant for millions of years, millions of births, and not get the result of offenses. So we have to know how to chant.
Yeah.
Mahaprabhu himself said this, Trinada Bhishanichana, this is how to chant.
Yeah. But
isn't
so many times in Srimad Bhagavatam, statements that even unconsciously, even in a deriding way, you are chanting, even unknowingly, you became in touch with the holy name, you are purified.
Yes, you are purified.
Or something.
Yes,
or
yes.
So many,
but prem.
Huh?
Prem is something different. Prema Bhakti is something different.
So this is a Svarupacitta Bhakti, which has no any seed of jnana or karma. It just deals with pure bhakti, Svarupacitta Bhakti.
The others need the association of bhakti to be considered bhakti. They're not inherently bhakti by themselves, but the
like
Bhagavad...
Like Arupa and Sanghasitta Bhakti, they need assistance of bhakti.
They need association with bhakti to not be just jnana, like detachment. What does detachment have to do with loving Krishna? There's no mention of love for Krishna in the word detachment.
It means that...
But detachment can assist you in your loving Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
But in itself, detachment... Like a snake is detached.
Yeah.
A monkey is detached to something.
Yeah. So
Hare Krishna.
This, last point that karma and jnana themselves cannot be maintained without bhakti. So
they can't bring the results because they're in the modes of nature. I heard Banu Maharaj explain it so in a simple way, because even jnana is in goodness.
Yes.
So goodness can't give you transcendence. So bhakti is transcendental.
Yes.
It is nirguna.
Not any material qualities,
but bhakti itself. Maybe I have so many material qualities, but bhakti comes from Krishna.
Independent.
It's his energy. It's his energy. Bhakti is his energy. Yes? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, I thought so. Do you mind Bhagavatam today?
Yeah.